Bibles that seem like we're being told to use our money wisely, and it turns out that what we're really being told is we need to know the character of our God. And this is another one of those parables. It's not about the wise use of money with a view to salvation in the next world. And it's not about the good that you can do by giving to poor people to somehow redeem your ill-gotten gains. What this parable is about is pursuing a relationship, getting to know your master so that you know his character enough so that you can throw yourself on his extraordinary and generous mercy. Let's pray. Dear Father, thank you for being so generous to us. And as we look at your creation and we see your power and we see your eternalness, let us remember too that there's that individual relationship, and let us help us pursue that relationship with you so that we can understand when we need to have you there, that you are there with your mercy and grace. In your name, amen. Berry picking. So blueberries everywhere. And literally hundreds of people are blueberry picking in Hatcher's Pass. And you drive there, and then just people just disappear off into the hillside and into the bushes. And you pick berries, and you pick berries all day, and you don't see other people, and you don't come to the end of blueberries. And it's just, and every day for like 3 weeks, hundreds of people are picking blueberries in Hatcher's Pass. And there's just blueberries there. And it occurred to me that those blueberries, they would be there whether we picked them or not. And I can deduce from that that God likes blueberries, right? Okay, so take a couple of steps and be with me. God likes blueberries. But every now and then, nature is not so benevolent toward us. Every now and then, we get out there and discover that nature really is an impersonal power. Ted and I were in the Outer Banks one time, and I've been to the Outer Banks several times, and every time I'm there, there's some sort of storm going on. And so we were at the Outer Banks, and there was a storm going on, and we were standing on the boardwalk looking out over the Atlantic Ocean, and it was just dusky, so clouds in the sky and the moon and a little bit dark, and the waves are just crashing and spray flying everywhere, and it was awesome power. And I stood there watching this, and I said to Ted, doesn't it make you want to just run out into it? And he looked at me, and he's like, let's go back to the RV. So yeah, well, I do guarantee you that if I was on a boat on that ocean, I probably wouldn't feel the same way. But standing there in the safety of the relative safety of the boardwalk, I saw the awesome power, the divine nature, and the eternal power of the Creator. So, all of this to say, we can know God through His creation, but we can't know everything about God, which is why Jesus came, which is why Jesus taught, which is why Jesus told stories. And so, we're looking at this parable, and we're going to find out something about God and His eternal power and His divine nature that we can't find out from creation. So we're going to take a look at this parable and see what that is. Okay, so I'm going to read it to you, even though you have it in front of you. I'm going to read it anyway because some people are just better with hearing than reading. So Luke 16, there was a certain rich man who had a steward, and an accusation was brought to him that this man was wasting his goods. And he called him and said to him, what is this I hear about you? Turn in the account of your stewardship, for you can no longer be steward. And the master said to himself, what shall I do? For my master is taking the stewardship away from me. I cannot dig. I am ashamed to beg. I know what I will do, so that when I am put out of the stewardship, they may receive me into their houses. So calling his master's debtors one by one, he said to the first, how much do you owe my master? And he said, 100 measures of oil. And he said to him, take your bill and sit down quickly and write 50. Then he said to another, how much do you owe? And he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said to him, take your bill and write 80. So the master commended the unjust steward for his prudence, for the sons of this world are wiser in their generation than the sons of light. Okay, quickly take a look at the form of this parable. This is a chiastic form. This is a modified chiastic form. So instead of having A, B, C, D, C, B, A, we have A, B, B, C, B, B, A. Does that make sense? So the first, the blues, the first and the last, are about the master and the steward and their relationship. The greens, the first set of greens are about the problem. The second set of greens are about the solution to the problem. And then we have that center part, which is the idea. And as we know with chiasm, that center part is what the parable is about. So as we go through this, we're going to remember that and we're going to focus on that center part. So this parable is interesting. You don't hear many preachers preaching on it because it is subject to a lot of confusion. It suffered at the hands of interpreters and translators and commentators basically since the 3rd century, when a guy that we call Julian the Apostate, he goes down in history as being an apostate, Julian the Apostate went to the Caesar of Rome at the time and told him that this is what Christians believed, that Christians taught that it was okay to cheat and steal from your master as long as you did something good with the money afterward. And so this was an incentive to the Caesar to start persecuting the Christians and outlawing Christianity because of this parable. So it has been allegorized. People look at this and try to figure out, well, who's the master? Who's the steward? What's he doing? What does it mean? It sounds like God is okay with this guy stealing money from his master. Some early Catholics have said that the steward represents the Jewish leaders and that the reduction of the bills represents them lowering God's standard of righteousness, which of course then doesn't square with the idea that the master commends the steward for something at the end. So what do we do with this parable? Well, we could just ignore it, or we're going to dig into it and see if we can't figure this out. So a question we should be asking is, what is the steward being commended for? Why at the end of the story does the master commend the steward? So when we're done with this, we'll be able to answer that question. Some of the answers that have been suggested are, well, does the steward turn honest at the end of the story? Is he just helping other people in need? Is the master actually the bad guy and the steward is the good guy in the story? Or is he trying to redeem his unjust actions? He steals from the master, but by giving it to the tenants, is he trying to redeem his own actions? A little bit farther on, there's a verse that says, let's see if I have a copy of it. Make friends for yourselves by unrighteous wealth, that when it fails you, they may receive you into an everlasting home. And that makes it sound like the story is about, like, if you can do something good with your ill-gotten gains, then that will make it more apt that you'll be able to get to heaven, right? So is that really what that means? Not sure. Unrighteous mammon, unrighteous wealth should raise a question. What is unrighteous wealth? Is this being contrasted with righteous wealth? So if you make your money the right way, is that okay? If you make your money the wrong way, had you better redeem yourself with it? So this is a question that was struggled with in the Middle Ages. If you read history, you see that a lot of people went plundering and stealing, and at the very end of their lives, they began to think about their afterlife, and so they decide to donate half of their wealth to the church. Hopefully that will buy their way into heaven, and that is based on their understanding of this parable. This is also a question today for a lot of nonprofits, like Solid Rock. Like, when we know that the money is coming from some shady source, you know, do you take a donation or, you know, do you turn it down? So we had this time once where I was working registration at camp, and this car drove into our parking lot that looked different than all the other cars there. And we're like looking at it, and somebody ran out, you know, and they're like, it's a Maserati. There's a Maserati sitting in our parking lot at camp, right? Okay, so this guy gets out, and when we heard his name, it was a name that people knew. He was famous, or infamous, you might want to say, as part of the underworld from Anchorage. He was a man who owned a string of the most well-known strip clubs in Anchorage. And he wanted to send his 14-year-old daughter to camp. So he brought her to Solid Rock, and he's going to enroll her in camp. So he stands there to register her, and he pulls this wad of bills out of his pocket, and he peels off in hundreds and throws them down on the table and goes, "Is that enough?" And we're like, you know, we blinked a couple times. and we're like, "Yeah, we don't need that much." And he goes, "Oh, just take it. Make sure she has everything she needs, and then you can just keep the rest for a donation." Okay, so we're gone. Do we take this unrighteous mammon? I'm not sure, you know, whether we should do that. We did. End of story. We did. So questions like that arise based on this parable. Okay, the righteous, unrighteous mammon, don't know. Okay, so as we look at this, there's four important things that we have to remember. Five. I feel like Ecclesiastes. There's five important things that we have to remember. First of all, when we look at parables, our question is, what does Jesus want us to know about God from this parable? So we're looking at the parable as God is the hero of the story. So once again, that's our key thing when we're looking at this. Okay, the other important things to remember are Jesus is speaking into a high context culture. And I've explained this a little bit before, and I'll just touch on it again, what a high context culture is. Jesus expects people to bring to his stories their understanding, their experiences, and their expectations. He doesn't need to delineate everything that he's trying to get across, because he knows that they know from their experience what he's talking about. So that's high context culture. The next thing is remembering that this is an honor-shame culture. This becomes super important in our understanding of the actions that take place in this story. The honor-shame, honor and shame idea is one of the most important concepts in village life in the Middle East. Okay, and then where does the rhetoric focus our attention? And as I said, this is a modified chiasm, so once again, we focus on the center. And then understanding how the Gospels are put together are also very important in understanding this one particular parable. So we look at the Gospels, and we have been trained to think that these are a biography. Okay, so Jesus was born, and then he grew up, and then as a young man he did this, and as he grew older he did that, and then he died, and so biography. So we are all familiar with biography. But even though the Gospels seem like on the surface that might be what they are not. The Gospels are not meant to be a biography. The Gospels are written by authors who are taking aspects of Jesus' life and aspects of Jesus' teaching and stringing them together to prove a point. And every gospel writer has a different viewpoint of how he is looking at Jesus' actions, because his end point is going to be different. So when we read certain things happening, it's not necessary that they're happening in chronological order. Now, I read from Luke, this parable is from Luke, and the way Luke puts things together is that he strings them together, like I said, to make a point, but they are based on what came before. So he's building, to make his point, he's building off of what he has already said. And sometimes it will be, like a transition will be because some wording sounds really similar and it's the same, or because he sees that there is a parallel between certain things that he wants to bring out. And in Luke, we have what is called the travel document, or the travel narrative. It's also called the Jerusalem document. So the travel narrative starts when Luke records that Jesus sets his face toward his final journey to Jerusalem. And it's a very long and very large chiasm. The center of it comes when Luke records Jesus Jerusalem lament when he says, "Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who killed the prophets." Okay, and then moving on from that. And then the end of that travel narrative or Jerusalem document is when Jesus actually arrives in Jerusalem for the final time. So this is where this particular parable is located, in that travel narrative. So we need to look at the surrounding recording to see where Luke is trying to take us. And so if we look back in Luke, right before Luke gives us this parable, he gives us three other parables. Okay, one of them is the parable of the lost sheep. Okay, and in the parable of the lost sheep, we have a picture of God's relationship toward us. He is concerned about us. He will go to great lengths to rescue us. And then the next parable, we see the lost coin. And in the lost coin, we have a picture of God who values us. And then we have the lost son, also known as the prodigal son. And then a prodigal son, we have a picture of a God who welcomes us home with joy. So all these pictures of God are leading up to this particular parable. We expect this parable to flow naturally from the idea of the lost son and give us a portrait or a picture of God and God's heart toward us in line with these other three things that we just saw. Okay, so the prodigal son is arguably the second most well-known parable in the Bible, just second to the Good Samaritan. So we're going to look briefly at the prodigal son and see what they have in common with what these two parables have in common with each other. So Bob, several months ago now, did several weeks on the prodigal son, the parable of the prodigal son. So I'm not going to go. I'm not going to go over all that because I expect that you remember what Bob said, right? So I want you to turn your page over and take a look at the chart that I have on the back. Okay, so the prodigal son and the unjust steward, what do they have in common? First of all, they have a noble master who demonstrates grace to an underling. In the prodigal son, this is the father demonstrating grace to the wayward son, and in the unjust steward, it's the master demonstrating grace to the cheating steward. Okay, then there is an ignoble underling who wastes the master's resources or others' resources. Okay, in the prodigal son, the son wastes his inheritance. In the steward wastes the master's goods. Interesting, because these two words are the same. In both the prodigal son and the cheating steward, the waste word is the same, and it has the same meaning. It means to throw to the wind, right? Wasting, like that, okay? Then there's a moment of truth regarding the losses. The son says, "I will arise and go to my father." The cheating steward says, "I have an idea. I know what I'm going to do." Okay, and then the underling throws himself on the mercy of the master. The son says, "I am not worthy." He says that to his father. The steward, he goes out and he cheats again, all right? Dealing with problems resulting from broken trust, the son offers his services as an employee to pay back his debt. The father, of course, rejects that. He doesn't even get a chance to say, "I'm going to pay for my own sins." The father just rejects it and says, "No, your sins are canceled," essentially. Okay, the steward, he is going to recruit community support to help him out. And in both, there's a celebration. In the prodigal son, we see the party. Bring the fatted calf, let us eat and be merry. In the cheating steward, you have to know. You have to know what's going on to be able to see that celebration. And we're going to see that celebration here in a minute. Okay. First of all, we're going to put the parable in its cultural context. This is an agricultural community. This is not a city. The debtors are tenant farmers. They're not trying to repay loans that they have gotten from a banker. So that's important to know that difference as well. So we're talking about an agricultural